You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Marlena Dout, Marlena L. Dout, Professor Marlena Dout. But I'm going to call you Marlena, yeah?
Yes.
Okay, good. Good. And, we've spoken once before. I would speak to Marlena just because it was so fun. But the occasion for this conversation is a book, The First and Last King of Haiti, The Rise and Fall of Henri Christophe. So, hi, how are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you, and thanks for having me on.
No, thank you, and thank you for being willing to spend some time and talk to somebody who knows almost nothing about Henri Christophe. In fact, truth be told, I had never heard of him before seeing the title of this book. So that puts me in the category of ignorant and yet at the same time curious. So there you go. But before we start that, can you give us a little sort of a potted biography of you are a professor at Yale now, but you weren't born that way. So how'd you get there?
No, I wasn't born that way. And I will say about your last comment, you're not the only one who doesn't know about Henri Christophe. The book was reviewed in the Times of London over the weekend. And I just want to read you this phrase that the reviewer said. School children studied the American, French, and Russian revolutions, but rarely the Haitian Revolution, the first slave rebellion that led to an independent state formed by free slaves. So it's just actually a kind of a phenomenon that it's Henri Christophe's life, but also just the revolution in general. It's not really taught in schools. And that's how most people are going to get information about big, huge world events. But yes, I did. I went to school in California, where I'm from. And I did not learn about the Haitian Revolution in school. My family is, my mother is from Port-au-Prince. We're Haitian American, us children. And so we did know about the Haitian Revolution, although very, very bare bones also, just that it happened. Here's some of the main players, Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, et cetera. I went to undergraduate at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. I did my graduate work at the University of Notre Dame, which is in South Bend, Indiana. So I learned about winter. And now I live in Connecticut, where I'm kind of unlearning winter, or I'm learning about a weird winter, weird kind of winter.
Yeah. And remind me, this is not the first book or dive into Haiti or Haitian history that you've taken.
No, this is my fourth kind of single-authored book. I first wrote about the Haitian Revolution in terms of its literary history. When I went to graduate school, I was really interested in kind of Francophone literature of New Orleans, which led me to 19th century Haitian literature, because the Haitian Revolution, in addition to being this kind of world historical event that made Haiti the first modern nation in the world to permanently outlaw slavery. And they, of course, created this independent Black state in the Caribbean. But in addition to that, it sparked a kind of wave of migration. So many of the former enslavers, we'll say, ended up in the United States in places like Philadelphia, Norfolk, Virginia, and a large part in New Orleans, Louisiana. And of course, Louisiana had been a French colony at a certain point, was sold to the United States as a direct result of the Haitian Revolution. So that's kind of what I was interested in looking at first. And then learning that there was also a vast literature of Haiti and how much of the interactions between Haitians and the rest of the world were reflected in this literature. And so that's what my first book was about.
Say that piece again about the occasion for the sale of Louisiana to the United States, to the then, I guess it was the United States.
Yeah.
Was the Haitian Revolution. Can you explain, like, why?
Yes. So in 1803, Napoleon Bonaparte, who is ruling in France as the first consul, now understands that he's about to lose the French colony of Saint-Domingue, which is today Haiti, which is the most lucrative, or was, before the Haitian Revolution began, the most lucrative sugar colony in the entire Atlantic world. But it's also hugely profitable due to coffee, cotton, indigo. I mean, it is making way more money than any of the other world powers colonies. Mm. But the Haitian Revolution was so advanced by summer 1803, pretty much everyone can see the writing on the wall. Thomas Jefferson, who's president in the United States, he can see it. Napoleon can see it. And so they start entering into talks about how the United States can buy the Louisiana territory, which is going to more than double the size of the United States, from France, because Napoleon needs money now. And without Saint-Domingue as a kind of place to ship the goods, or, you know, he doesn't need Louisiana. So to make goods and a place to ship them, he doesn't need Louisiana. And so Jefferson buys the Louisiana territory for $15 million, 80 million francs. And that, of course, leads to just more migration. So there's several influxes in New Orleans that happen pretty much as a direct result of the Haitian Revolution, and also slave revolts and rebellions, as you might imagine, that directly happen in the United States, but also in New Orleans in particular, as a result of the Haitian Revolution.
And so, okay, so Christophe was a slave in what is now Haiti, yeah?
Well, that's a very good question. Christophe was actually born on the island of Grenada, which at the time of his birth is a British colony. It had previously been a French colony, but the French had lost it during the Seven Years' War to the British. And you have to think at this time, even when I'm talking about Louisiana and France, the United States, this was not really that uncommon. You know, when the world powers would end a war, they would trade territories in the Americas around like chess pieces or like trading cards or something. And so he's born on this island, most likely enslaved. And he fights, however, during the American Revolution at the Battle of Savannah in 1779. Now, how was he going to get from Grenada to Georgia? Well, the French general who led that battle, it's a man named Comte d'Estaing. And in 1779, he led a siege on the island of Grenada on behalf of the French, but is actually technically a part of the American Revolutionary Force campaign in the Caribbean.
Right.
And he wins Grenada back for France for a short time, and he takes many prisoners and enslaved people included with him. And from there, they go on to Saint-Domingue briefly to kind of restock, and then they travel to North America, where D'Estaing had already been participating in the American Revolutionary War. So it's this kind of extraordinary trajectory that most likely ends with Christophe gaining his freedom, because that's what's supposed to happen if you fight in the American Revolutionary War. But he was only 12. So it is possible that when he ends up back on the island of Saint-Domingue, or ends up there, that he could have also found himself subject to enslavement just without any kind of protection.
Enslaved again. Okay, so when did he lead this revolution, this rebellion?
Yeah, so I would say the things we know for sure are he's born on the island of Grenada, because one of his principal writers writes his history while Christophe is alive, and, and there's other people who knew him there. Battle of Savannah, same thing. But in terms of his parentage, just don't know. And so it's, we say, unlikely that he had free status at birth just because Grenada was a slave colony. But yes, what we do know for sure is the Haitian Revolution breaks out in August 1791. And by 1793, Christophe is fully coming into the frame. He's participating. He's one of the freedom fighters. He pretty quickly ingratiates himself to the two French commissioners that are sent to the island, or who are sent to the island to restore order, but end up being forced to abolish slavery because the freedom fighters are not going to lay down their arms.
Right.
These commissioners recognize this pretty quickly. And so after that, for services rendered to the French now republic, the French have killed their king and declared a republic, Christophe rises in the ranks of the French military and eventually achieves the rank of general, a free black French general on the island of Saint-Domingue.
Well, and was there ever a conversation about sort of anywhere in the papers about sort of, you know, making the trip to France? Or was he in... He was in the New World, and that was it.
Yeah, I mean, he sends his son, François Ferdinand, his oldest son, to France to be educated, which many prominent free black men did. Yeah. They would send their children to France. Toussaint Louverture, for example, is the most well-known of the freedom fighters, but plenty of others as well. So he does that. And there is some rumor that as the revolution progresses and things are getting more uncertain, that he might want to go to France, but it's truly a rumor. And in fact, you know, the French are engaged in it. Once Napoleon comes to power, the French really begin to engage in a lot of duplicity, because you have to imagine that the former enslavers, who many have fled, but some want to come back and, you know, reacquire their properties, but they're going to have to pay laborers to work on them.
Right.
So they don't really agree with this. And they know that Napoleon Bonaparte is unhappy about emancipation. And so they're hoping and praying that he's going to restore slavery. And in fact, that's exactly what he will try to do. Yet, well, he did succeed on the island of Guadeloupe and elsewhere in French Empire, because in 1794, the French revolutionary government ratifies the end of slavery in all French colonies as a result of what happened in Haiti. So if you imagine the enormous impact this is having, this small corner of the world. But when Napoleon comes to power, he is just incensed by this idea of, you know, unilateral abolition of slavery. So when France reacquires the island of Martinique, which is where Napoleon's wife is from also, France reacquires this, and they say slavery is going to be maintained there. They don't abolish it. And the French Republic is supposed to be one and indivisible, so there can't be laws for one place that don't apply in the next. But Napoleon changes the constitution to say that there can. There can be different laws in France where slavery is not allowed on metropolitan French shores than that reign in the colony. And so in July 1802, he succeeds in reinstating slavery through, of course, military arms on the island of Guadeloupe. But things unfold differently on Saint-Domingue. He sends his brother-in-law, General Leclerc, to the island with initially about 30,000 troops. This is the largest fleet to ever set sail from France. And their mission is to kidnap Toussaint Louverture, turn Dessalines, who will be the founder of independent Haiti, Christophe, and the rest of the freedom fighters against one another. Pit them all against one another so they start to turn on each other, and to the point that they'll either kill each other, arrest each other, betray each other. And instead, they pretty quickly, after the French arrest Toussaint Louverture and deport him to France, pretty quickly figure out what's happening, and they form what's called the Armée Indigène, the indigenous army, and they defeat France on and they declare independence on January 1st, 1804.
Wow, that's really, yeah, it's one of those. I'm sure history is replete with those, but sort of it's a momentous event that somehow, you know, they dropped that page.
They definitely dropped that page. That's just wild. A big movie about Napoleon. Nothing at all about this.
Do you have a story about, well, I would hope you do, but do you have a story about why they dropped that page?
Yeah, absolutely. They dropped the page because Napoleon is supposed to be a conqueror. Napoleon's claim to fame in France is that he stomps all over Europe at the Battle of Austerlitz, right? There's like a metro stop named after this. You know, his remains are there prominently in Paris. You can go and visit them. Like, this is a hero. And even though he's ultimately defeated, the story is, you know, oh, the coalition, the British at the Battle of Waterloo, they all come and they, you know, are against him. And so this is an inconvenient story.
Yeah.
When I published an article called Napoleon Isn't a Hero to Celebrate in the New York Times, first of all, my friends teased me that I made an entire country of people angry at me because the backlash was just enormous. Like, I just ran off Twitter for a few days by like angry French people. And, you know, they just kept saying, you know, he created the Banque Nationale, which is, he didn't do it by himself. The lycée system, the high school system, which he also didn't do by himself. And were just so unwilling to recognize that that person could do those things that they like, but could also do terrible things. And that also none of those things he did were applied to Black people in the colonies, that they didn't get to go to the high school or benefit from the Banque Nationale. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, one journalist wrote to me and said, you know, in school in France, they would teach us that France was the only country in the world to have ever abolished slavery twice without ever explaining how such a feat was possible.
How they managed to do that.
Because France doesn't definitively abolish slavery until 1848.
Oh, well.
Napoleon dies in 1821, but he's forced to finally abdicate his throne in 1815. So they actually cannot blame it on him, even mm-hmm. though some might be wont to do that. It was a deeply ingrained part of French society, and slavery had many supporters in the era. And I think that's just a deeply uncomfortable thing to recognize and reckon with. On a national level, it happened right. in the United States as well. The inability to really think about how the country was founded and what that means moving forward.
Well, and also the, you know, I don't remember when we got the first little, you know, fragments of sentences that made reference to slave rebellions. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, this was a, as I understand it, this was a widespread thing throughout the times of slavery. And, you know, that's not, you know, we get to the Gettysburg Address, we get to the Emancipation Proclamation, and there's no mention of widespread slave uprisings. So it would have to have been very inconvenient, and still to this day, very inconvenient to hear that there was a revolution led by slaves, former slaves, et cetera, and just right down there, right there, you know, right off the coast, sort of.
Yeah. I mean, we weren't that far off from Jacques Chirac, the former French president, basically implying that Haiti had no relationship to France when approached about the infamous indemnity that France forced Haiti to pay as the price of recognition of its freedom in 1825. And Jacques Chirac was like, that has nothing to do with us. Like, the inability to really kind of think about that is also on display. They have monuments now in France that list some of the names of the formerly enslaved peoples of Martinique and Guadeloupe, but they don't have any names of people from Saint-Domingue, right? Like, it's just excised from the cultural memory and from the school system also.
Right. It's interesting. And well, you tell me, you know, Haiti is, I suspect most people who've paid any attention over the years, Haiti is a hemispheric embarrassment to not Haiti and the people of Haiti, but the fact that for so long, it is, you know, it is always, it's always gets the shortest end of every stick.
Yeah.
It has so many issues and problems after everything. So many, takes so much longer for anything to recover there, right? I mean, poverty levels are amazing. Is there a line to be drawn from the revolution by Henri Christophe to the fact that Haiti is sort of the forgotten, it's just the forgotten blemish. It's just there. Is there? Or am I making this up?
No, I think that, well, first, the world wanted to punish Haiti, right? But, and so immediately after Haitian independence, so Thomas Jefferson is still president. Interestingly, in 1803, he was willing to consider some, you know, ties with Haiti for trading purposes. But, you know, the Southerners in the United States get so upset and scared also by the Haitian Revolution that by 1806, Jefferson institutes a trade embargo against Haiti. So this means Haiti is a largely import-export society. They're exporting the kind of those cash crops, but they have to import basically everything else.
Everything else, right.
And if you cut that off, you can effectively starve them. You can keep them from having supplies for the hospitals, which is exactly what happened. And this trade embargo lasts until 1810. And how you know capital is the king in the United States is that the trade embargo is allowed to expire because the northern merchants are upset because they are making money hand over fist by trading with Haiti and even in an illicit trade during that period of the embargo. And they're watching Great Britain really flourish through its trading in coffee with Haiti, and they want to do that. Yeah. So, but still, no formal recognition, so much racism on the floors of Congress every time the question comes up. France is repeatedly, throughout Christophe's reign, Christophe becomes president of Haiti in 1807. He becomes king in 1811. He dies in 1820. Throughout that entire 13-year period, France is trying to, quote unquote, retake its former colony, restore Saint-Domingue. That's the language they used, which means bring back slavery and French domination. So on the one hand, you have these constant economic threats. You also have the eastern side of the island, which initially is a French colony still. France retains control until 1809. And then you have the Spanish, and they still have slavery in Spain, right? So you've got this enormously fraught situation where Haiti is this island of freedom, this bastion of freedom and Black sovereignty in the middle of an extremely hostile Caribbean Sea and hemispherically, or in the Atlantic world frame, however you look at it, there are threats coming from every single corner. And then Christophe dies in 1820. His successor, a man named Jean-Pierre Bouillet, becomes president, and he signs a truly disastrous agreement with France to end this kind of state of war that they've existed in. And it says that as the price of France is kind of relinquishing their hold on the colony, recognizing Haitian sovereignty, Haiti will pay France 150 million francs. At the time, every other nation, if you look at newspapers, is going, this is crazy. This would bankrupt any country. In England, they're saying there is no way. And yet that's the agreement. And when Haiti does, in fact, default on that agreement in 1838, the French reduce the total amount of the indemnity to 90 million francs, but require Haiti to take out these really high interest loans to pay it back. And this is the situation that persists throughout the rest of the 19th century, leading up to the U.S. occupation, which is technically about this indemnity. The United States occupies Haiti for 19 years, from 1915 to 1934, completely dismantle the government, rewrite all the laws, constitution, everything. And it's all in the name of making sure that Haiti pays loans to German and U.S. banks associated with the indemnity.
Right. Wow. So there's a vivid line to draw between those events.
And it's money. And the line, you follow the money, and you can really see the strings being pulled.
So why was this the occasion to write about Henri Christophe? Was there a deeper something?
You know, at first it was truly, I was fascinated by this person who was so caricatured following his death. So caricatured, you know, every epithet. There is an article from the 1940s that calls him Black Hitler. That's the name of the article.
Oh, wow.
And it's like the hyperbole that people used to describe his reign, they would call him Nero and Caligula. Like,
oh, wow.
Create this, yes, like, every terrible person from world history.
Pick a terrible ruler.
Pick a terrible ruler and then compare Christoph to him. And these were famous authors doing this. The Nobel Prize winning writer Derek Walcott from St. Lucia, you know, calls him this tyrannical despot, compared him to the pharaohs of Egypt. I mean, again, just every terrible, you know, epithet. Then Aimé Césaire, the famous Martinican poet and playwright, says, oh, he's just like all the white kings. It's like, well, no, because those white kings were ruling over places with slavery, like George III of Great Britain, or that all the kings of France, like, ruled over societies with slavery. So every single thing was just extremely hyperbolic when it came to Christoph. And so
he was a mixed bag. Yes. I mean, I know everybody is, we both are, and everybody else is, but he did have those. I mean, he did have those strands to pick on, right? I mean, those blemishes of his own.
He did. I mean, we have to think about, he's a person who becomes a monarch, and it's a constitutional monarchy. But it is, it's an absolute monarchy at the same time, right? So there's a
contradiction there.
Yeah. He's known for this massive citadel. It's the largest fortress in North America. It sits atop one of the highest peaks in Haiti. Today it's called the Citadel La Ferrière. It's been designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It is, people call it the eighth wonder of the world. But how do you get such a massive structure? Well, labor. And so Christoph had instituted what they called a corvée, which in the kingdom, because this word is interpreted differently by people, in the kingdom, the corvée was labor in lieu of taxes. So there was a law that Christoph passed in his 1812 book of laws called the Code Henri that said that idleness was essentially outlawed. You had to make yourself useful to the state. So that's different from being useful just to yourself, be useful to the state. So are you working on a farm? Are you in the military? Are you working in the schools? Like, you got to do something. You can't just like have a restaurant and make your own money, right?
Right.
And so if you can't pay your taxes because you don't have a way to be useful, you get sent up for hard labor. You also can get sent up for hard labor for breaking laws. You can get sent to prison. The citadel is vast like a city. It has a hospital, a castle, a printing press. They throw parties up there, but it also has a prison. In fact, it was initially constructed before Christoph's reign as a prison, and he massively expands it. So you can imagine that, yes, people die in the construction of this edifice, exhaustion or being worked too hard. So he is for sure a mixed bag, but he is no Caligula, no Nero, and certainly not a Hitler.
Yeah. And is there a lot of evidence that he sort of, that it was not his own freedom and grandeur that he was solely seeking, but that he really had, whatever to call it, a love of the country and his fellow citizens and wanted to uplift people's lives? Or,
yeah.
Or did that get lost somewhere? In the accoutrements that go along with being king.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that he genuinely had a true love and affection for the Haitian people, for his country. I do not think that he grew up in an environment where he saw rule that wasn't by force and domination.
Yeah,
he had no examples anywhere else in the world where he could see that, because even though people love to look back and think, oh, the United States, well, no, because there was slavery in the United States. And Haitians knew that all the presidents, except for John Adams at that point, had been or were enslavers. Right. And so he doesn't have any good examples. Right. So he is written about as the most benevolent of the rulers of the time. By British abolitionists, British naturalists, even journalists in the northern United States. He actually, during his life, has an amazing reputation. The British naturalist Joseph Banks looks at his book of laws and says, nothing any white man has ever created has been equal to this. Thomas Clarkson, after the famous British abolitionist, after Christoph's death, writes a letter to the American clergy And he says, you never had in all your presidents a man so great as Henri Christophe. And again, this is not to excuse him, because I always tell my students, yes, things people can believe differently in a certain time period, but there are always people who know that it's wrong to dominate others, to oppress others, to use violence to get what you want. And it is a myth that they're the only men of, the only people who are men of their time are the tyrants. What about everybody else, right? And so, like, they also lived in that time. And so I say we have to approach, not even necessarily, it's not with nuance, because that's also an easy way to say we can excuse certain behaviors. With understanding, who is this person? Why did he do these things? What is the legacy and effect of doing these things? And the problem with Christophe is that only the bad things are remembered. So yeah. If you take like a George Washington, like only the good things are remembered.
Right.
Christophe has the opposite problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Except for the cherry tree incident, right?
Oh, yeah.
He did jump on that bad tree.
That is not even, I mean, that Ona Judge, I don't know if you've read that book about Never Caught, about the woman that George Washington pursued, who ran away, the enslaved woman, woman he enslaved, who ran away, and he pursued her for the rest of his entire life, trying to get her back. Everyone following her movements around the country.
Property is property after all, right?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Quite amazing. And are there lessons to be learned there that are relevant to now? Why, like, you know, there's so many people who approach history as, well, why am I, like, what's the point? Why am I, what should people get from this? What should people be thinking about this? Why is this something that, not that it has to be, but is this something that sheds light on how better to take the next step today?
You know, I truly think so. And I have, so I'm writing this book also, you have to think about, in the midst of Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, gets assassinated, you know, and I'm writing this book about a person who wasn't assassinated, but took his own life in 1820 because there's a revolt and rebellion against him. His predecessor, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Haiti's founder, was assassinated. And so then I watch as the country kind of descends, Haiti, contemporary Haiti, into further and further chaos, violence that is really seems extraordinary even when compared to past, you know, crises. And I keep coming back to the fact that Christophe was adamantly against this indemnity. He wanted to protect Haitian sovereignty at all costs, and he refused to put it up for sale. And when I look at the long succession of rulers who followed him in Haiti, they called themselves presidents, but many of them were anything but in the way that they behaved. I see people who wanted to enrich themselves. I see people who wanted to play nicely with the world powers for whatever they believed that it could get for them. I see very few, not all of them unilaterally, but very few rulers who I think had the general best interest of the Haitian people at heart. And to me, that's what separates Christophe, because if he really truly only wanted money and glory, then he would have taken different steps towards the indemnity. That was floated in his time period. And he used one response. He said, inadmissible. And he actually puts a trade embargo against France, which hurts, you know, the Haitian economy, but it's to prevent the French from continuing to send these ships, to pave the way to reinstate slavery. Mm-hmm. So when I see rulers now who, okay, they get overthrown, but they've got a house in Miami, or, you know, baby doc, Jean-Claude Duvalier, then he goes and lives in Paris. You get overthrown, you don't live in, but who suffers? It's the Haitian people who are there in Haiti, many without the means to leave, and they don't want to leave. It's their homeland, and they're the ones who always suffer.
Mm. Luckily, none of that stuff goes on here anymore, anyplace else in the world.
So, well, you know.
It's really quite something. Yeah.
Something.
It feels very timely, actually.
I think so too, but I'm, you know, it's like I am loath to make too, because I feel like there's like, Paul Farmer had this famous book called The Uses of Haiti, but I just, as someone who studies, you know, presidents, but not of our country, presidents and rulers, I see so many dangers. I see so many traps. I see so many things. And again, I hesitate to make comparisons because it feels like a dangerous thing to do, but at the same time, you know, the precipice is before us.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Yeah. Did anything surprise you as you sort of dove deeply into the life of the times of Henry Christophe? I mean, were there things, so you have been familiar with what is said about, what is written about Haiti for years, then you take on this project. Were there any sort of eye opener, like, whoa, that's
for sure. I would say, so a common phrase that people use when they talk about Christophe is they say he crowned himself, which is a kind of funny thing to think about. Also, like, do they mean it literally, or do he have, you know, the crown of your head? Like Napoleon literally put the bottom. But because technically he didn't crown himself, he was crowned by a bishop named Father Cogne Prel, who was a white French priest from Brittany, who had been his friend in the revolutionary era. They stayed friends, and he was a huge Christophe supporter. But he also, I was also surprised to, like, I was curious about the process of, did he just wake up one day and say, I want to change my title from president to king? Like, what happened? And so as I was, because I truly didn't know, people don't, first, if people even know there's a king, they definitely don't know how it came about, right?
And right.
So,
right.
So I, going to look into this, I found, well, first of all, that he had counselors of state, and they are the ones who in March 1811 say, we think you should change your title from president to king.
But really? Then,
yes. And so then I'm thinking, okay, well, why? Well, you know what reason they cited? So Toussaint Louverture had a huge rival, a man named André Rigaud. This is during the revolutionary period. They caused a huge civil war to happen in Saint-Domingue between these two generals who were fighting each other for control over kind of who's going to be in charge of the military. And André Rigaud loses. He is forced to go into exile. He has kind of like, he's detained in France, we'll say. He's in prison at one point, but he's mostly detained, prevented from leaving, surveilled. He returns to Haiti in April of 1810, on the exact anniversary of Toussaint Louverture's death. Toussaint Louverture died in France in the prison they were both imprisoned in, but at separate times, called the Folle de Joux, on April 7th, 1803. Rigaud returns on that same date and tries to overthrow the government that's ruling in the South. Because something I haven't mentioned is that Haiti is split into two during Christophe's reign. There's a republic in the South led by his rival, Alexandre Pétion, and Christophe's in the North, first as president, then as king. And when André Rigaud returns to the South and tries to overthrow Pétion, the counselors in the North say, we think republics might be a little too fragile. People need to know who the successor is. Let's create a constitutional and hereditary monarchy. That way things will be more stable. And because if somebody overthrows the king, then there's a natural successor instead of this vacuum that happened when Dessalines was assassinated.
So was there this was a hereditary monarchy?
It was a hereditary monarchy. Yeah.
So Christophe kills himself.
Yes.
Because of a revolution.
Yes.
So what happens?
Well, because...
Is there a son? Is there a daughter? Is there a something?
Has a son, not the one he sent to France. That child, unfortunately, was killed by the French and left to die, I should say, abandoned in the streets of Paris in retaliation for his father's participation in the revolution.
Wow.
But Christophe has two daughters. So he had the older son who's deceased, then he has two daughters, and he has the heir to the throne, Victor Henri, who's the youngest of his legitimate children, I should say. And the men who overthrow Christophe and essentially lead to his suicide, they executed his son.
They did.
Around 10 days after Christophe's suicide, they execute his son. They also execute his son from a previous relationship. So technically his eldest son, Prince Eugene. They execute him. They spare the women. But which suggests to me that they very well understand the power of this idea of the hereditary monarchy.
Yeah.
Because when Dessalines ruled, he was actually an emperor. So Haiti's first iteration is the Empire of Haiti. Dessalines is Emperor Jacques I, but he rejects the idea of a hereditary monarchy. And so when he's assassinated, that's what created that who's going to rule and contest for power. There was no named successor. And this is what Christophe and the counselors of state were hoping to avoid, but they couldn't because the rebels against them, who wanted to overthrow them, really did understand the power of that provision.
Well, this is I'm not sure this is a fair question, but so do you end up, I recognize it's a mixed bag always.
Yes.
But do you end up having admiration for Christophe in any way?
I don't think I would go so far as to say admiration. I would say sympathy. When I think about him participating in the American Revolutionary War, technically he's 11 when he begins this campaign.
Unbelievable, right?
He turns 12. The Battle of Savannah happens 3 days after his 12th birthday. So he's already there, like digging trenches. If you just imagine, people tend to think like, oh, childhood was different back then. No, it wasn't. People's ideas about it were, but a child was still a child. They had a brain of a child. They had, if their parents separated from them, they have all of the feelings that, right, that children have. And thinking about that, and what does he see? What does he learn about the world? How does he survive into adulthood? And then he ends up in Saint-Domingue, which at the time has the reputation of being the cruelest slave colony in the Atlantic world. So when I think about the things that he saw, I can only have sympathy. But it isn't an excuse. And it isn't, the parts of his history that are, pretty ugly are not admirable. And, at the end of the book, I get to a place where, I'm describing everything that befalls his wife in the wake of her husband's death, just calamity after calamity. She goes to England initially. She lives with the Clarksons, but she's made fun of by British press and people following her around, hounding her. The climate is cold. They're constantly sick, her and the two daughters. She takes them to Italy. Then one of her daughters dies tragically. Then the other one dies even more tragically. She falls and hits her head and, just dies, gets, some type of brain injury and dies. And now she's all alone. She's got diabetes. She ends up having one of her legs amputated. This unethical doctor donates her limb to the medical society there in Pisa, Italy. And it was on display there. There's like a tag for it. We don't know what happened to it, but it was on display there. It's just so terrible. And the British press were still following her. Even in Italy, she couldn't get away. But then I got to a place where I say in the book, looking at a testimony of somebody whose family members were jailed and people he knew were killed by the Christophian regime. And I just ask, I wonder if her pain isn't the most important here, though, because her husband caused other people to experience the sense of loss that she was experiencing. And she did lose a lot, but so did a lot of other people.
Sure.
And I think to get to that place of understanding, that's part of it. We have to understand that there was harm all around. There was. Just the fact of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. That's an amazing story. It is an amazing story. Marlena, before we go, because I want to be respectful of your time, what is there more to say? If there is anything more to say about this, other than buy this book, read this book.
Yes. I mean, truly, I want every teacher to teach the Haitian Revolution. That's what I always, my broader mission. I create educational materials as well. For example, if you were to Google the first and last king of Haiti, there's a TED Ed video that I created years ago, that is just 5 minutes. School teachers around the world are teaching it. It's been viewed more than 600,000 times. We created lesson plans, everything for it. Oh, because wow. My goal is for people to teach the Haitian Revolution, learn about the Haitian Revolution, and hopefully gain lessons from this fortitude. Because, you know, these people who fought in the revolution suffered mightily. And sometimes I think about their fortitude after everything. Dessalines was whipped as a slave. He had scars all over his body. He probably had brands all over his body as well.
Right.
And the idea that you would say, I'm going to lead this country and I'm going to create all these laws and they're going to be flawed and experimental and it's not going to work out, but I have that dream. And so that is the other thing that, you know, fascinates me about this time period is that people still thought they could make the world better. They had seen the worst part of humanity. We could forgive them if they thought every human being was capable of the worst at any moment and hated humanity. And they didn't. They didn't. There's a huge lesson in all that for all.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Well, Marlena Dowd, thank you so much for being willing to spend some time and let me be dumbly curious about things I don't know at all. So thank you.
Well,
I really appreciate that.
Thank you so much. I really enjoy talking to you.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.